Wow, I am pooped. That's a weird way to start an episode, right? Well, we're doing things a little bit backwards. My perception of time is different than your perception of time, because this is the beginning for you. But I am recording this intro after already having completed the actual episode, the actual excavation notes in this episode. The reason I wanted to do that is it's the first time doing an excavation episode. So I wanted to, number one, see how long it is, so that when I came into the intro, I can tell you what's in front of you. And I also wanted to know what the experience was like, so I could tell you also what the territory is like. I can tell you this. If you are about to dive into this, you have a Joe Rogan-sized episode in front of you. So I'm going to try to be quick on this because there's so much in front of us already. So the regular episodes, the scout episodes, those are scout notes. Those are my general impressions of my experience from listening to something almost always as an audiobook. Every once in a while, I can't get a book as an audiobook. So then it would be my impressions of reading a book for the first time, but not really taking notes. And it's usually super casual, and it's just about my thoughts, my feelings. Hey, I listened to this audiobook. Here's what I thought. Here's a little bit about it. In contrast, these deeper dives, these excavation episodes, is what I call them, scout notes and then excavation. Scout is just checking out the territory. Is this book any good? Excavation is digging things out. The excavation episodes, they come from careful reading, slow, meticulous reading. I read a physical book if I can get it. I get a physical book of it. I take notes on it, of everything in the book that resonates with me. But the excavation episodes are not book summaries. This is not a Cliff Notes. My purpose here isn't to encapsulate everything that's said in this book, because that's the point of buying the book. That's why you should read the book. All I'm doing is grabbing, I'm excavating pieces that are interesting to me. And then I'm looking at all the pieces that I've pulled out and making new sense of those pieces out of the context of the rest of the book. I'm filtering them through myself. And my hope is that you will learn something. You will understand some of what the person is saying, because I'm trying, instead of presenting my own thoughts and feelings, even though I'm filtering this through myself, I'm filtering their thoughts through me. So I'm trying to convey their thoughts as opposed to normal episodes where I'm conveying my thoughts. So my hope is when you hear me explaining what I get from their thoughts, what I've made from these pieces I've pulled out, that you'll actually want to go read the book and see the whole entirety of the book. I don't read for ideology. That's kind of in the description of the show, which means sometimes I read things that I don't agree with. But my job here is not to tell you what I agree with or what I don't agree with. My job here is to go, hey, I'm curious what's said in that book, and then to present what's said in that book that stands out to me. Whether it's good or bad, I'm not going to moralize. I'm just going to explain what's there. I want you to go read the book and formulate your own opinion, your own belief. Could be a book written by the worst person in the world, and I'm going to tell you what that worst person in the world said. And then I hope that you'll go read that book so that when you say this person is the worst person in the world, you can provide specific examples from their own words. As opposed to just trusting me. Why is that person the worst person in the world? Because Curly said so. That doesn't mean anything. That's a disservice to you. I trust your intelligence to go and do these things yourself. And that's the point of the excavation episodes, to just what is being said here. Anything beyond that is for you. It's for you to go and decide. Now, I try to, when I do this, take as few quotes as possible from the books. Today's book is a little bit of an exception because it's just eminently quotable. But the reason I do this is I'm trying to filter it through me. I don't want to just provide you fragments from somebody else's thinking. I want to tell you, hey, I read this sentence. I thought about it. Here's what I think of that idea. Here's the idea. Here's what I'm understanding of that idea. And it's important to understand that an excavation, like I said, is pulling pieces out. What does this all mean in the context of each other, away from all of that? And that's why it's different from the book, and that's why the only purpose is to get you to encounter some of these ideas so that you can then go see them in the context and the order and the organization and the full picture that the author provides you with. That is the difference between a summary and an excavation. And that's why what we do are excavations. Okay, let's get into the actual excavation notes. The book we're going to be looking at is The Creative Act by Rick Rubin. This was published this year, 2023. The subtitle is A Way of Being. So The Creative Act, A Way of Being. It's 406 pages, fairly thick book. And I really recommend, if you are going to read this book, to buy the paper book. It comes in hardcover and it has not really a tan, but it's like a white gray linen cover. I've scratched the cover in previous episodes, but that's what it sounds like. It has a nice little texture to it. It's just a beautiful little book. Not really little book. It's just a beautiful book. The reason I recommend, though, that you buy in physical form is not necessarily because of how beautiful it is, which is a bonus, but because the way that this book is written, it's not really intended to be read the way that I read it, which is the way you read a normal book from beginning to end. Now, obviously, you want to do that, probably, if you buy a book. But I think the real purpose of this is to have this kicking around so that when you are actually in the creative act, when you are actually working, or you're thinking about it, or you need inspiration, or you're at a blocking point, that you can pick this up and just kind of flip through it and find something. And the writing in here is very intentional. I would almost compare the writing in this book to something like a book that you would buy on, I'm trying to think of an example. I can't think of a specific example right now, but not a book on meditation, but a book about a Buddhist mindset, like a book full of aphorisms. I read one recently, but I can't, for the life of me, pull it up in my memory, because unfortunately I listened to it as an audiobook, and books of aphorisms are not usually great audiobooks because you're meant to read a line or two and just sit and contemplate. And the audiobook experience is about moving forward. So it's a little overwhelming. And at times this book can feel that way. I didn't listen to this as an audiobook, but if you were to listen to this as an audiobook, I could imagine that, because it's written in a way that is meant to instill a sense of contemplation into you. And in that way, it's not a practical guide. There's not step-by-step stuff in here. This is really a book about being in the creative practice, what that feels like, and kind of offering, I don't want to say advice, but just offering options of things to think about. So that's what I believe Rick Rubin, and I forgot to mention this, as a co-author. He had Neil Strauss help him write this. These are all his ideas, but Neil Strauss helped him with the structure. And if you don't know who Neil Strauss is, Neil Strauss has helped a lot of people write books. You may be aware of the term ghostwriter, and Neil Strauss has been a ghostwriter on many books. I believe Neil Strauss was the ghostwriter on The Dirt, the Motley Crue book, because come on, you know those four guys did not write that book. Neil Strauss, he kind of fits into a certain genre that, for a while, I don't want to say genre, but a certain style of ghostwriting that kind of bothered me. I guess maybe it fits for all ghostwriting, but it bothered me for a while, and now they seem to be, as an industry, moving away from this. But generally, for example, you pick up Life by Keith Richards, and it says Life by Keith Richards. Keith Richards didn't write that book. In fact, Keith Richards most likely never even sat down with a pen or paper or a typewriter or a computer ever. All he did was talk to someone, a ghostwriter, and the ghostwriter would take notes and take notes and then take notes and take notes. And then they would put together a draft of, you know, like, okay, let me arrange this into an order. What's my narrative here? And then they would present it to the person whose stories were there, and they would tell them what they thought of it, and then they would tell them what, you know, whether they got details right or wrong, or they'd add details or change their mind about something. So there is a co-creation there in that sense, but it used to bother me because these people's names would be on the front because it sells the book, but they didn't actually write the book. This is a different case. Actually, let me give you a couple other examples of Neil Strauss. I said Motley Crue. He also did Dave Navarro's book, Marilyn Manson's Long Hard Road Out of Hell. But this is a different case. I've heard Rick Rubin talk about this book, and he actually wrote stuff. He was actually working on this book for many, many years before he even brought Neil Strauss in. He was just writing his ideas on process. He had no idea how to structure it and put it into a book. And in fact, I think he originally, before he went to Neil Strauss, he approached Stephen Pressfield. And Stephen Pressfield told him, like, nope, you need to do it. I'm not going to write it for you. You need to do it. So Rubin went back to the process more and more. And then he got to a certain point where he's like, okay, how do I make this into a book instead of all these journals that I have? Now, I haven't heard him specifically say this. I've picked up these pieces from conversations he's had on his podcast, Tetragrammaton, with other people, in one including Stephen Pressfield. So the reason that the book looks the way it does, the reason it has the tone that it does, the reason it has such a strong voice is because Rick Rubin actually wrote it. This isn't just a ghostwritten thing. And when I said the industry is moving away from that now, before they used to hide the ghostwriter's name completely. Now when you go to buy a lot of books, you will see, like for example, you would see if you go to the first page with writing in this book, it says The Creative Act, A Way of Being, Rick Rubin. And then near the bottom, it says with Neil Strauss. In this case, I believe Rick Rubin's name could be on the cover alone because he did actually do some writing here. But, you know, like, for example, if you go pick up Donald Trump's book or Barack Obama's book, they did not write those. So when you would go buy those now, it might say Hillary Clinton with, and then it'll say that, you know, the ghostwriter's name. And they've been doing that a lot more recently. I've noticed it, and it's on the actual cover of the book. And I think that's a good movement because it's more honest. These people shouldn't have credit for being authors. Yes, they're stories, but in all honesty, the ghostwriter is writing a memoir or a biography of someone, and they're doing interviews. The fact that the person happens to be alive is a convenience, but it doesn't mean that they're the actual author. So I appreciate that Rick Rubin put that in here, and I think that's why this book has such a strong tone. And because of that, I believe when we go through here, and I say I believe because this is the first episode, but I believe this episode is going to have more direct quotes from the book than I would normally do. And what I mean is when I go through excavations, I don't generally pull out a lot of quotes. I try to rephrase things as much as I possibly can. But in here, because the voice is so strong, sometimes the idea is so perfectly stated that for me to restate it myself, I would actually just be rewording their words. Like, oh, can I swap out run for jog? And then it's in my own words? No, it doesn't work that way. So because of that, we're going to have a little bit more direct quotes. And you'll understand why, because some of these things are things that, you know, could be a t-shirt or a tattoo. These are some strong statements. In the sense of a strong voice and a strong message. And I don't mean strong as in overpowering. I just mean that it's well-defined and it's worded often perfectly. In fact, the first thing that we're going to talk about is a quote from the book. And I put this quote first because I think this encapsulates pretty much the whole idea of the book, or at least this is the foundation upon which the entire book is built. And that quote is, we are all antenna for creative thought. And what he's talking about here is this idea that creative thought is something we receive. And this is a very important distinction on the way that Rick Rubin and people like Stephen Pressfield as well think about the creative process. They don't believe that creative ideas and creativity comes from inside of us. They believe that it is a signal that we receive. Now, this is somewhat metaphorical, but I say somewhat because they do believe that the ideas come from outside of us, that we are receiving inspiration. Rick Rubin believes that it comes from what he calls the source. In fact, the cover of the book has a circle with a dot. It's just a black circle with a black dot in the middle. This is a symbol that's known, I don't actually remember where the origin of this is, but this is known as the monad. And the monad is a symbol of the source. So he's pretty much put this at the central, as the central idea of the book as well, by putting that on the cover. And the source, you could reword the source however you want. It's a way of expressing what some people would refer to as God. Some people will refer to just as inspiration. Some people will refer to as the universe. You know, these terms of something bigger than us that exists outside of us, something grander than us. And the source is a reference to not just a source of creativity, but the source of all things. Once again, could be used as a word for God, which Stephen Pressfield would, I believe, say that it is God. Now, this is very similar to the way that Rick Rubin looks at this is very similar to the Roman concept. So the Romans, as far as I understand, I'm not an expert on Romans and Roman spirituality, but the Romans, as I understand it, believed that there were three spirits. I don't want to say inside of us, but there are three spirits that play a role in every individual's life. And I say play a role because some of them are inside of us and some are external. So the three spirits that the Romans believe play some role in each individual's life. We have the anima. The anima is the spark of life or consciousness that animates each being. In other words, it's the difference between the rock and the squirrel. What is it that brings this thing to life to move around on its own and have a will of its own and to do things and to be aware, in the case of humans, be aware of its own existence? That is the anima for them. The second is spiritus. If you are Roman Catholic, you may remember there's a blessing in Spiritus Sancti. That's the Holy Spirit. So spiritus is just spirit. Anima is animus, is plural. We've heard animus. But the spiritus is the essential, is the immortal essence of each person. This is what carries on after we die for the Romans. And the third is genius. A word we know, but this is the actual origin of it. And the genius is what they believe to be a guiding spirit. Not one guiding spirit that guides everyone, but every individual person has a genius. And that genius is what influences your personality, your individualism. It influences your talents. It influences your interests. And it influences your choices. It's basically the thing that steers you towards your destiny in your life. Now, Christians took these three concepts and combined them all three. So the animus, the spiritus, and the genius became what Christians might call the immortal soul. But for the Romans, they were separate. And what Rick Rubin talks about in here when he talks about this signal coming from the source is very similar to the genius, the idea of the external genius. And the thing about receiving a signal from outside of us, that means that in order to receive this creative signal, we have to make space for it. We have to be prepared for it. We have to be ready for the signal, which in itself is a very esoteric idea, which is probably why it reminds me of something else esoteric. There's a writer named Mitch Horowitz. He writes esoteric topics. He has a Medium, you know, the website medium.com where people write articles. He wrote an article on there called Tarot and the Law of Cycles. I think this goes all the way back to like 2019. And this, it's an article about tarot, or a concept from tarot cards. And the card that he's talking about with the Law of Cycles is the Wheel of Fortune. Something we're very familiar with, not only because it was a popular TV show in the 80s, but we just hear the Wheel of Fortune. We hear this term. But what is the Wheel of Fortune? Well, the Wheel of Fortune is literally fortune, chance, opportunity. And it's the reason it's a wheel is because it spins. It spins towards us in our favor, and it keeps going, and it spins away from us against our favor. Good luck, bad luck, and everything in the middle. And because it is a circle, a wheel, a cycle, there's an ebb and a flow. Luck and fortune departs, but then it returns, and then it departs, and then it returns. And what Horowitz says this means in his article is that if you remain where you are, what you're doing, eventually fortune will come back around your way. If you're having a hard time, eventually that wheel is going to turn. It's going to come back towards you. And we can see this. This is obviously, to some degree, we can see this in a very practical, real sense when we think about probabilities. Think of a slot machine. If you sit at a slot machine and you pump in a quarter and you keep losing, you know that if you pump enough quarters in there, eventually you're going to hit the jackpot. It's just, that's the mathematics of it. Eventually the Wheel of Fortune will come to you. The whole bet on a slot machine is not whether you will ever hit a jackpot. The bet on the slot machine is, will I hit the jackpot before I spend more money than the worth of than the value of the jackpot? And if the jackpot's $500, it's pretty awesome if I get the jackpot and I've only put $20 a quarters in. But if I put $700 a quarters in to win $500, that's not very good. But we know that eventually it will come around towards us. So that's a very practical example of how the Wheel of Fortune ebbs and flows. But that's just about kind of what the card means. Mitch goes on to say that in order for us to take full advantage of this cyclical nature of fortune, it's not that we must just remain. We actually need to be prepared. We need to be working towards the idea that fortune will come towards us. This is an interesting concept, and I want you to think about it in the context of being a podcaster, since that's what we're doing right now. We're listening to a podcast, or you are. I'm making one. If I'm starting out, and like, for example, right now, this is like episode 6, 7, I don't know, I lost count. If I got somehow this episode to go viral, would it be a good thing or would it be a bad thing? In my case, I think it would be a good thing because I've done podcasting in the past, so I'm more skilled than I was when I did my 5th podcast or 6th podcast ever. But if we go back to then, the 5th or 6th podcast I ever did, which was awful. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't even know how to talk into a microphone very well. I didn't know how to edit the sound. There were pops and background noises and all kinds of stuff. There was that, you know, that fuzzy room noise. If then somehow my episode went viral, that wouldn't be necessarily a good thing for me. Because say 100,000 people hear that episode, that means 100,000 people hear me being unskilled, unprepared, and that's the impression of they have of me, of my show, that it's not good. So in that case, it works against me because I wasn't in the place for the fortune to come to me. But whereas if fortune came to me now, where I'm a little more skilled, I'm a little more prepared on the microphone, I know how to prepare notes, I know how to do all of the audio, and I know how to post things, and all the things I didn't know then, I know how to do now. If fortune came around, it would be better for me. Not that everyone would like it, but 100,000 people, I would get more people interested in the show now than I would on the show that I was doing back then on the 5th episode, because I was in a place to be prepared for fortune. To say this another way, it's to your advantage when you begin doing something like YouTube or podcasting, that you are anonymous and unknown when you start, because nobody's paying attention to you. And when nobody's paying attention to you, that allows you time to learn how to do what you're doing, so that when you are good and people discover you, they discover something they like instead of something they dislike. Now, going back to how this relates to what Rick Rubin is saying here, the creative signal is coming and going. You know, it comes when it wants to. We need to make space for it. We need to be prepared to receive it. So for example, if you get ideas about painting, but they only come once every 6 months, in that 6 months time, what you should be doing is learning how to be better at taking an idea and representing it on a canvas. Learn how to use your tools better so that when the idea comes to you, you can execute it better. You can get closer to this vision that has come to you. And the thing about people who choose to be artists, they choose to do this because of the sensitivity that they have. They have a sensitivity to the signal. They have an ability to hear or receive the signal better than other people do. They are able to have more of these creative ideas, as we would put it now. This is why it's important to think about what Rubin is saying here about the external. Because what that can mean is that instead of when we think about creativity coming from inside, that becomes a judgment about the value of the person. Mozart was a genius. Why? Because he had these ideas. I don't have those ideas. Therefore, I am not a genius. Or to put it another way, I am not as good as him. I am not capable of doing anything like he did. But if we see it as something that comes outside of us, that we receive, then we're all coming from the same place. Now, some of us have more sensitivity than others, but others can learn to harness their sensitivity in a way that it's more powerful. Just as the way the person who naturally receives the better signal can learn to do that even better, so can a person whose signal is weak learn to make that a little bit better too. And I think that's why this is an important idea for Ruben, is that it's not about the ego and it's not about the person. It's just about working with what's in front of you. The other thing that can be said about the sensitivity of the artist is, in some way, this may explain why so many artists either commit suicide, become alcoholics, overdose, or even just why they use drugs, why they use prescription drugs, why they use alcohol. Why are they seem to be more susceptible to these things than the average person? And Ruben believes that's because of the sensitivity. They have a sensitivity to the signal, but along with that sensitivity to the signal also comes a sensitivity to other things. They're more sensitive to pain. They're more sensitive to suffering. They're more sensitive to anxiety. They're more sensitive to depression. So in order to dull those sensitivities, they often seek ways to numb themselves. Drugs, alcohol, other addictions, etc. Which unfortunately is also why when they start getting really down the road of the drugs and alcohol, that what they make sometimes gets worse because they're also numbing their signal from the source. So good and bad with that. Another thing about receiving a signal is the idea that ideas have their own time. What I mean by that is, or what Ruben means by that is, ideas have a time that they want to come into the world. What Ruben presents is not necessarily theories. I think he's just offering ways to think about things. It's not necessarily that you have to buy into what he believes. It's just that these are ways to think about the things that may be beneficial to you for your creative process. So in other words, they could be true or they could be useful fictions. Either way, he believes that they may help someone be more creative to think about these things. So the ideas have their own time. So if we think about the genius, going back to the Romans, so you have this spirit that's above you. I think what the Romans used to say about, I think this was the Romans, somebody else might have said this, but it fits the Roman idea of the genius, is that above every blade of grass is an angel saying, grow, 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 grow. And in a way, that's kind of how you want to think about how they saw the genius, is there's angel behind you or this spirit behind you. Or in other cultures, they use the word demon or daemon. This is before demon got to be associated with evil. Demon just was D-A-E-M-O-N. But the idea was just a spirit. It had no one way or the other. In fact, I believe demons could be both. They could go either way. But that's the idea of the external thing giving you ideas. But these ideas that they're giving you, they're giving them to you because it's time that they came into the world. That's the intention of these things. This is an idea that needs to come into the world. This is an idea that needs to come into being. Because of that, it doesn't matter who gets the idea. The ideas don't care. We'll talk about her more in a minute, but this is something Elizabeth Gilbert, this is one of the main points in Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic. Elizabeth Gilbert is the woman who wrote Eat, Pray, Love. But her book about creativity, Big Magic, talks about the idea of ideas like almost being geniuses, being spirits, external spirits. And the reason I bring up this idea of ideas having their own time is this is a way of explaining why oftentimes several people who are unrelated to each other, oftentimes they don't even know each other exist, they have the same creative idea at about the same time. You could see this in movies. Here's some examples. Armageddon and Deep Impact. These movies, I think, came out the same year, and they're both about asteroid about to hit the Earth. Weird. Why all of a sudden did we make two movies about asteroid coming to hit the Earth? Because the idea's time had come. The Prestige and The Illusionist, two movies about magicians, came out, I think, the same year or within about the same period of time, completely independently. You have to remember, when we talk about movies, to us, movies come out. But oftentimes, movies sometimes are in production for decades. You know, they could be in this holding pattern, and then there's a time where they have to try to get the money, and then there's a time where they have to write the script, and they have to redo the script, and then they got to bring in a director. So it takes, pre-production could take sometimes decades. There are a lot of books that have been optioned that are just sitting, and nothing has gone on with pre-production. So when we say these things happen at the same time, it really is has to be independent, because the chances of them copying each other are pretty much astronomically difficult because of that time scale. You don't know the time scale. Just because this guy over here has a movie about magicians doesn't mean you should make yours right now so that they can come out at the same time, because you don't know when theirs is coming out. And in fact, you don't know when yours is coming out. The fact that they come out at the same time is often a surprise. For example, a big one, A Bug's Life. I think that was the Disney one. But then at the same time, Ants came out. And I think, if I remember this correctly, Ants didn't do as well because A Bug's Life was out, and I think people got them confused. Two cartoons about insects. Then we have This is the End and The World's End. One is about celebrities facing the end of the world. The other one is about friends on a pub crawl. They're going on a pub crawl before the world ends. Another great example is there was a band from Australia called The Saints, and they are often referred to as a punk band. But the thing about The Saints was their sound sounds like punk music, but they developed their sound completely unaware that in the United States and England at the time, the punk movement was happening. It hadn't reached Australia. So the fact that they sounded like punk rock was one of these coincidences, that the idea happened at the same time. Now, going back to Elizabeth Gilbert, I said that this is a central idea in her book, Big Magic. And I'm actually going to read what might be the longest quote I'm going to read in this episode, which is not even from Rick Rubin. But the reason I'm going to read this whole quote is because I have tried to condense this story. And it's just really hard to condense this story in a way that gets across what happened in any way better than the way Elizabeth Gilbert tells it in Big Magic. This is a story where she finds out that her friend and fellow author Ann Patchett is writing a book that's pretty much the same exact book she's writing. So here's the story. In the autumn of 2008, Ann casually mentioned, oh, I should warn you, by the way, there's a curse word in here. I don't generally curse in these episodes, but I will when I'm doing a direct quote. I don't like to censor people. So just a warning if you're a child or you're with a child. In the autumn of 2008, Anne casually mentioned in a letter that she had recently begun working on a new novel and that it was about the Amazon jungle. I wrote back and asked Anne what her novel was about. More specifically, I explained that I too had been working on an Amazon jungle novel, but that mine had gotten away from me because I had neglected it, a state of affairs that I knew she would understand. In her next letter, Anne replied that it was too soon yet to know precisely what her jungle novel was about. Early days still. The story was just taking shape. She would keep me informed as it evolved. The following February, Anne and I met in person for only the second time in our lives. We were to appear together on stage at an event in Portland, Oregon. The morning of our appearance, we shared breakfast in the hotel's cafe. Anne told me that she was now deep into the writing of her new book, more than 100 pages in. I said, okay, now you really have to tell me what your Amazon novel is about. I've been dying to know. You go first, she said, since your book was first. You tell me what your Amazon jungle novel was about, the one that got away. I tried to summarize my ex-novel as concisely as possible. I said, it was about a middle-aged spinster from Minnesota who's been quietly in love with her married boss for many years. He gets involved in a harebrained business scheme down in the Amazon jungle. A bunch of money and a person go missing, and my character gets sent down there to solve things, at which point her quiet life is completely turned into chaos. Also, it's a love story. Anne stared at me from across the table for a long minute. Before I continue, I must give you to understand that Decidedly unlike myself, Anne Patchett is a true lady. She has exquisite manners. There is nothing vulgar or coarse about her, which made it even more shocking when she finally spoke. "You have got to be fucking kidding me." "Why?" I asked. "What's your novel about?" She replied, "It's about a spinster from Minnesota who's been quietly in love with her married boss for many years. He gets involved in a harebrained business scheme down in the Amazon jungle. A bunch of money and a person go missing, and my character is sent down to solve things. At which point, her quiet life is completely turned into chaos. Also, it's a love story." Incredible confluence right there. That really does give credit to the idea that ideas come from outside of ourselves, and then when they want to be brought into being, they want to be brought into being. And the point of this story for Gilbert is not only that this is one of the main reasons that she believes that concept, because how could you not when something this insane happens? But it's also the idea that when an idea comes to you, you got to use it, because if you don't, it's going to go find someone else. And she, her contention is that she had this idea for a novel and she wasn't, you know, she let it get away from her. She was neglecting it. So the idea said, "Peace," and went and found Anne Patchett. So that when Elizabeth Gilbert actually picked up her novel again and started writing it again, her and her friend were writing essentially in many ways the same book. Now, of course, it wouldn't turn out to be the same book because you have two different people writing this idea. Even with that many things in common, the two books, from what I understand, I haven't read them, are very different. And yes, they both finished the book and published the books. The books are called The Signature of All Things, and the other one is called The State of Wonder. Actually, I think it's just State of Wonder. No, the. Just a crazy, crazy story. Almost unbelievable. Almost unbelievable. Which brings me back to The Signal. Rick Rubin talks about how The Signal can fill us with ideas. But we need to take advantage of that signal as much as we can while we're receiving it. We must, you know, wring it dry. We need to, as I think he uses the term, you have to ride the wave. Here comes this big wave, ride it until the wave is gone. Don't just take a little dip from it. Take the whole wave as much as you possibly can. He even says, you know, if you have to stay up all night, sometimes do it. But staying with the signal, it's not easy. Because the thing about the signal is that you have to have faith. Because, well, faith, as Rubin, this is an actual quote from him, he said, "Faith is rewarded perhaps even more than talent or ability." That's a bold statement. Faith is more important, or at least it's rewarded more than talent or ability. Because the reason I see that is what he's saying is that without that faith in the idea, your talent and ability are wasted. You know, what is talent and ability without an idea for which to apply them? So the faith is the primary thing that is needed when you're receiving the signal. But what is the faith? What faith in what? Another quote from him. "We are required to believe in something that doesn't exist in order to allow it to come into being." You have to have faith that this thing, this idea in your head, which, as he says, does not exist. You have to have faith that it is going to become something in order to make it into something, in order to make an idea into something, to bring it into the world. You have to believe that it can become something in the world. And that's a tremendous amount of faith. So the signal gives you ideas. You have to be ready to receive them. You have to ride them out. And you have to believe in them. Now, when we talk about bringing things into the world, we can easily confuse that and start to look at creating as being about making something. About the artifacts, as I think is the word he uses here, is artifacts. I'm not sure if that's his word or my word. But artifacts being, you know, when you paint, you make a painting. When you write a song, your artifact is the song. When you sculpt, your artifact is the sculpture. It is the thing that exists when you finish the process. And while you have to have faith that this idea is going to manifest, it's not actually about the thing that manifests. The process is not about the result. It's not about the paintings or the songs or the sculptures, but rather creating is a way of expanding beyond ourselves, expanding beyond who we are. At its heart, creating is about seeking something. It's about seeking forth from outside of yourself. It's about widening your experiences, widening your perceptions of yourself, of the world. Creating is a journey. Another quote from Rubin, "The universe is only as large as our perception of it." When we cultivate our awareness, we are expanding the universe. That's an interesting idea. That the universe, what we see as the universe, what we see as existence, what we see as everything, is only as big as we perceive it to be. So we have to cultivate our awareness. And when we do that, we expand the world. To put that into more examples, we often talk about, as a society, we often talk about the advantages of travel. You know, we want to send children to school abroad. We want to travel, you know, so a lot of people used to do this thing between high school and college. They would go to Europe. They would travel the world. They would see the world. And one of the reasons that we would do this is because it expanded their minds. It expands our minds. Travel expands our minds. And the reason travel expands our minds is because if we are from Texas and we've lived in Texas our whole lives, then what we see of the world, what we perceive of the way the world works, the way that people live, is only as wide as what we have seen in Texas. If we are from California, which is decidedly different than Texas in many ways, and we've never left California, then that is how we perceive the way people live and the way the world works. Or maybe we've gone across the country and we've widened our perspective, but we've only traveled in the United States. It's only that wide. So by traveling other places and seeing other people living, we are expanding what we understand about how it is to live and what people are like. And because of that, our perception of the world expands. It widens. That's one of the advantages of traveling, is to learn to see more than the narrow perspective that we have because of where we are standing. It's just like in real life. If you're standing in front of your house, you can only see so far, but if you take 10 steps forward, now you can see further down the street. This is also one of the reasons that isolation, or more specifically, solitary confinement in prison, is destructive to the mind and the mental state. People that go in there for too long, they start falling apart. Damien Eccles is one of the West Memphis Three that was convicted of killing a child in the 80s. They were sent to prison for decades. They ended up being completely innocent. They were exonerated and released. I think they had to do some kind of plea. It doesn't really matter. But Eccles had a hard time at first because he had been put into solitary confinement so many times that his mind was starting to unravel on him. And even to this day, being out for as long as he's been out, he still has problems with memory and certain things, not just his memory in prison, but just the way his memory functions from the detrimental effects of being in solitary confinement, because his world, his perception was limited so much that the brain started to break down because that's not the way the brain is meant to function. And I also, having been a person who in the past has dealt with severe anxiety and severe depression, I've always said that the process of going through depression and anxiety is like eating yourself alive. Because when you are in a state of depression or a state of anxiety, you start focusing on yourself more. And as you focus on yourself more, you're reducing your perception of your world. You're reducing your perception of others. And it keeps narrowing and it keeps narrowing. And it becomes like this spiral, this tightening circle that slowly, slowly spirals inward and gets tighter and tighter and tighter until it completely swallows itself up. That is the narrowing of perception. But back to being an artist. Being an artist is not a job or an action. As the subtitle of the book says, being an artist, engaging in the creative act, is a way of being. And that way of being is a practice of attention. It's a practice of where our attention is and deciding where our attention is and learning to direct our attention. To be an artist is to pay attention to things, to see what is there and what other people are missing. Or to quote Ruben directly, to live as an artist is a way of being in the world, a way of perceiving, a practice of paying attention, refining our sensitivity to tune into the more subtle notes, looking for what draws us in and what pushes us away, noticing what feeling tones arise and where they lead. Being an artist doesn't mean being freed from difficulty, though. Freed from discomfort. You know, there's this idea of, you just need to pay attention, you need to hone your perception, and everything's going to be all good. No, it's not. Go back to that sensitivity, right? Everything has its gives and its takes. You get the sensitivity to that signal. You also get sensitivity to pain, to anxiety in that same way. Being an artist doesn't mean you get to be freed from the difficulty and the discomfort of the creative process. Everything doesn't suddenly become easier because you're an artist or even a good or a great artist. In fact, adversity is actually a constituent part of the creative process. And what I mean by constituent part is I mean you need that piece. Kind of like, you know, the axle that connects the two wheels on the car, that's a constituent part of the car. The car is not going to go anywhere if you don't have an axle because the wheels won't be attached. And adversity, in that way, is a constituent part of the creative process. Stephen Pressfield, I mentioned him earlier, in The War of Art and many of his other books on creativity, he talks about resistance with a capital R. That's this adversity, the resistance that we face in the creative process. And when he thinks about the creative process, rather than thinking about it as a way of being, Pressfield thinks of the creative process as going to war, going to battle. That every day you have to get your arms and you go to battle. And what do you battle? You battle resistance. So in that way, resistance isn't something you can avoid because you can't go to battle without something to battle. So the resistance is part of the creative act itself. And for Pressfield, fighting it is what the creative process means. There have been many, many authors who have talked about the difficulty of writing books. And it's kind of something that comes up enough. If you read enough interviews, you know, like you read Paris interviews, which are like these famous interviews that have been done for decades and decades with authors about their writing process, you will hear frequently that writing a book doesn't get easier. Just because you wrote book one doesn't mean that book two is easy now. Oh, I know how to write a book. In fact, there's a quote it's supposedly this comes from Dean Koontz, who's written many, many books, but I can't really find the source of where he said it, so I don't know if this is really his, but either way, the sentiment is here, whether it is from him or somebody else wrote this. Finishing one book merely means that I know how to go about starting the next. Having written a novel doesn't make writing the next one any easier than the first was. So in other words, let's put this in a different way. You go to write book one, and you're beginning your battle. You're battling to bring this book into existence. And you do it. Every day you show up and you write that book. When you get to the end, all you've learned is how to write that book. When you go to write the next book, you're starting over. There's no head starts. There's nothing. You're starting over. The battle is a new battle because that battle is the battle of this book. How do I write this book? So the artist can't be freed from that difficulty and discomfort. And the effort that we exert and the struggles that we face are a good thing in another way as well because they keep us aware of the process. They keep us engaged with the process. If we were freed from the challenges of writing a book or making a painting or writing a song, it would be really easy to become absent during the creative process. Why pay attention if it's easy? If there's no struggle, then what keeps you in the moment? This is funny. I'm reminded of a brief trend in these games on the phone that are called tower defense games. Essentially, you have towers and there are enemies coming towards you, and you're building towers to stop the enemies from getting to your base. That's the basic understanding of it. Now, generally, the way these games work is you have round one, and then you have waves within it. So you go to round one, and within round one, there might be 10 waves of enemies. So you go to round one, first wave comes through. Okay, build more towers for wave two. You're earning money as you're killing these things. Wave three, wave four, wave five. Then when you get to wave 10, round one's over. Now you go into the next map. But there was a trend a couple years ago in games where this round, the idea of the round was pretty much non-existent. And the idea of the wave was just continual. So what that meant is you could set up your towers and just let it run. There was no requirement for you to push next wave. There was no requirement for you when you finished the round to go to the next map. And there was also another mechanic in these games where if the enemy got through and you quote-unquote died, it would just kick you back like 10 rounds and continue from there. So essentially what this means is you could set something up on these games, put it down, and just let it run and walk away. And then come back later and be like, oh, I have a whole bunch of gold now because, you know, every time you die, it just, you know, kicks you back. So it just keeps collecting gold even though you're dying. Now you build up your defenses even more. You fortify your defenses even more, and then you let it run on its own. And I think this trend went really fast because it's really freaking boring. Because you're not engaged in the process. There's not much required of you. The game plays by itself. Examples of these games, there's one called Idle Monster TD. These are iOS games. I'm just giving you the examples if you want to go look to just kind of see what it looks like. There was also a He-Man game from the cartoon He-Man. It now seems to be gone from the App Store. But both of those were that kind of game. I don't know what you would call that game. But it reminded me of this, that without the challenge of having to be involved in the tower defense, the game is not a game. There's nothing to play. It's just running a program. And it's incredibly boring. And if the creative process was easy, if writing a song was easy, it would be boring. Because the challenge and the difficulty is what we actually come for. So let's talk about obstacles. Some of the obstacles that we face are doubt and imperfections. Imperfections in ourselves, but also imperfections in what we create. But doubt and imperfections, they're not meant to be purged. Just like what we said about adversities, these are forms of adversities. They're not meant to be purged from the creative process. Because without them, like I said about the game, things become mechanical, but so do the results. The artifacts that we create also become mechanical. Without imperfections, a song is incredibly boring. It's mechanical. It's predictable. This is one of the reasons why I think AI music, you know, music that AIs create is not interesting yet, is because the AI are making theoretical algorithmically perfect things. So there's no, as people would say, there's no soul in it. Turns out soul comes to some degree from imperfection and from doubt. And the reason for that is our doubts, our problems, our imperfections, our fears. Those are the things that we as a human are contributing to the process. It's not our talent. Our talent is just a mechanism. But what we're actually giving the work of art we are creating is our doubt, is our imperfections, because those things are what make it uniquely ours. The way that I play one guitar line and the imperfections in what I play are what make it sound like me. Whereas what Jimi Hendrix plays and the imperfections in what he does make it sound like him. And when Thelonious Monk plays on the piano and the imperfections and the doubts that he brings to that are what make it sound like Thelonious Monk. That the voice, to some degree, the thing that we are, our soul that we're putting into this process is our imperfection. So because of those imperfections that we are contributing to the process, the artifacts, the art that we create, actually reflects who we are in the moment. It is a representation of us. It is a snapshot of us as the artist in that moment. There's a idea in Japanese pottery called kintsugi. I believe actually there's a Deftones album called that as well. What this is a process where you have pottery, and when the pottery breaks, what in kintsugi, what you do is you put the pieces back together, but what you put them back together with is gold. You pour gold into the crack to make the pieces stick together, because the gold sticks out. So instead of hiding the flaws and the mistakes, it actually accentuates them. That the cracks become the story, or as we say about scars, the scar is the story. And that's kind of what imperfection is here with us. What we're contributing to the process is not the pottery. It's the gold that's being poured into the cracks. But it must be said, though, there is a difference between doubting your work and doubting yourself. Doubting your work is saying, I think maybe that drum part could be better. I think maybe that eye is a little off of center. I think maybe I could redo that. But doubting yourself is, I suck. I'm not good enough. One is about working through the process. The other one is about essentially running away from the process, pushing yourself out of the process, escaping the process. But as well, there's many ways to see these things. When we think about fear and the fear to create something, the doubt there, we can think of that as a weakness, but it's not a weakness. All it means is when we are afraid to make something and we choose not to make it, we're not doing that, as I said, because we are weak. We're doing that because at that moment, the fear of being judged for what we create, for who we are, that fear is stronger and more important to us than the desire to create. And sometimes that's okay. Sometimes we're just not in that place because art requires vulnerability, and we aren't always willing to expose ourselves to vulnerability. Another quote from Rubin, sharing art is the price of making it. Exposing your vulnerabilities is the fee. So in that way, we have to decide, we have to weigh. When I make this, I'm going to share that. Is it more important for me right now to make that or to protect myself? And it's not always the easiest decision. And other times we're driven away from the process because of the limitations we face. Limitations in ourselves, limitations in our process, limitations in the results. Often we say things like, it's not what I saw in my head. And it's so frustrating because you're like, I saw this thing in my head, but what I'm making is not turning out to be that thing. Happens all the time with writing. You have this idea, like in fiction, you have this idea for a story, and you go to write the story, and it's not turning out to be what you saw in your head. The first draft is sloppy, and it's just not working out, and you just want to quit. And the reason for that is the ideas, as it exists in our head, they're amorphous. They don't have a shape because they're in our heads. They don't exist in the world. So until they exist in the world, they don't have a shape. So in our heads, they are shapeless, which means that as we need them to, they can shift with our whims. Today, it's a little more sci-fi, but tomorrow, it's a little more fantasy. And that's okay because it never really had a shape. So the changing just kind of works. It can always be perfect in our head because imperfection comes from shape. And until we start to make it, to bring it into the world, that's the moment when we begin to see the actual imperfections of it. We begin to actually give it dimension, to give it shape. So in order to create, we have to accept the idea that incarnation means imperfection. That what we bring into the world will never be what we see in our head. But if we work with the limitations, if we accept those limitations, what we discover is that we end up in places that we never imagined existing before. We had this idea for the book to be A, and we end up at J. But when we were thinking about A, we didn't know J existed. We didn't know K, M, L, P. We didn't know any of those existed either. And the only way we found those things was because we went through the process and accepted the limitations. The limitations become a bridge to new worlds. There are two sides of our brain when it comes to the creative process. There is this amorphous side. This is the inspired artist part of our brain. It deals in abstractions. It deals in ideas. It deals in inspiration. The other side is the craftsperson. And the craftsperson's job is to take these ideas and actually try to bring those abstractions into the world, to give them dimension, to give them shape. And our conflict as artists often come from the frustration of that process, because the transference from an idea into tangible reality, it's not a mapped territory. It's not a set process. It's not something that can be automated. So the things that we craft often, almost always, fail to measure up to those images in our head, and that creates conflict. And that makes us want to quit. In that way, limitations, as I said, being the bridge, limitations are the reason often that we end up innovating. And actually, an example I give all the time for this, the Beatles, they wanted to be like Chuck Berry. They wanted to be like Jerry Lee Lewis. They wanted to be like Little Richard. That's the sound they were going for. They failed. They didn't sound like that. They couldn't sound like that. Sergio Leone made spaghetti westerns like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Those were nothing like the American westerns that were supposedly the style that he was doing. The Ramones wanted to be this band called the Bay City Rollers, which was kind of a pop group. Instead, we ended up with punk rock, reggae. People in Jamaica, musicians in Jamaica, they were listening to these records from Motown and these American R&B records. They're going, let's make that. Let's make that here, because it was hard to get the records. So let's start making our own music. But they couldn't sound like them. And what ends up happening is the limitations of all these, the Beatles, Sergio Leone, the Ramones, reggae artists, they can't end up sounding like those things, because those things sound the way they do because of the people who made them. Remember the things that we contribute to the process, those imperfections? Chuck Berry sounds like Chuck Berry because he's Chuck Berry. Bay City Rollers sound like the Bay City Rollers because they are the Bay City Rollers. So the Ramones can't be the Bay City Rollers because the Ramones are the Ramones. So what ends up happening when they fail to achieve the thing that they're trying to imitate is instead they create something that is their own voice. They innovate. And another important part of that process is our ignorance. Our ignorance is just as important. Sometimes we innovate because we aren't aware that we can't. We aren't aware that we can't do that. To quote Rubin again, sometimes the ideas that least match our expectations are the most innovative. By definition, revolutionary ideas have no context. They invent their own. Revolutionary ideas invent their own context. This reminds me of something that Kevin Kelly said in an episode of David Perel's podcast, How I Write. He said, you should work on stuff that doesn't have a name, stuff that's hard to describe. For example, when podcasts came out at first, it was really hard to explain what a podcast was. Kind of like radio, but that's the stuff you should work on, he says. That's the most innovative stuff. Another example, Jack Kerouac. I've talked about him before in the context of Truman Capote, not understanding what he was doing. What he created, this spontaneous prose that he created, had no context, which is why so many people were offended by it, because they had no context to it. It was foreign to them because it sounded like nothing else. It invented its own context. If we go back to another book that we read, The Victorian Internet, the idea of the telegraph, people didn't understand how the telegraph worked because they had no context for it. And I think we're seeing a lot of this same thing when we see conversations about AI. We don't know what we're talking about with AI because AI has no context. It's going to create its own context. We don't know what it's going to be or what it's going to do until it does. But what's great is often these imperfect versions of things, you know, you do something and it's just not that thing in your head. often those imperfect versions are actually the correct versions. Because if we continue and we keep trying to perfect that thing, sometimes we perfect all the magic out of it. That the thing that's quote-unquote perfect isn't as good as the thing like five steps before that wasn't quite there. One great example for this for me is a story I heard about Bruce Springsteen when he was recording the album Nebraska, which is my favorite of his albums. If I remember the story correctly, he recorded the songs, just him and a guitar and a tape player. And I think it was even in a bathroom. Just really raw demos. This is the way demos usually are. They're just these raw, okay, I'm just capturing the idea so I don't forget it. And he took those songs to the E Street Band, which is his band, and they sat and they fleshed them out. You know, they added, here's the saxophone part, here's the bass line, here's the drums, and there's these talented, talented musicians. And they brought all those songs to life, and they weren't as good. And Springsteen realized something got lost. And the version of Nebraska we hear is essentially the demos. You know, obviously they went and maybe did a little studio magic to clean it up a little bit. But the album Nebraska is actually just the demos. In fact, if you look online, you may be able to find it. One of the songs written for Nebraska was actually Springsteen's biggest song, Born in the USA. Now, Born in the USA didn't end up being on the Nebraska album. That's actually a song that they took and they fleshed out and they used the E Street Band version. But you might be able to find that demo version. And I don't know, personally for me, I think the demo version's better. Because there's a story in there, a really tragic story in that song that gets, I think it's lost in the bombasticness of the studio version. But when it's just him and the guitar, all you can do is listen to the story. Sometimes the imperfect version is the correct version. So when you go to create things, Ruben essentially is saying that you have to set limitations. Because setting limitations is like selecting your palette. When you go to paint, deciding what colors you're going to paint with. You know, artists don't generally go to a painting and go, every color that exists in the world is available to me. Often they pick a palette, or a graphic designer is a great example. Okay, we're going to be working with this color, and this color. So those are going to be our main colors. That's going to be our color palette. They set the color palette, and then they work from that, and they work in tones of those colors. You know, it's like going into a song and saying, okay, this song, no drums on this song. That's the limitation we're setting for this song. We're going to make this song with no drums. There was a guy who wrote a novel, I don't know how many decades ago, where he challenged himself to not use the word the most common word in the English language. He said, can I write a novel without using the? He set a limitation. One of my favorite shows of all time, Homicide: Life on the Street, which unfortunately, Andre Brower, one of the great actors in that show and in many other things, just died recently, so tip my hat to Andre Brower. But Homicide: Life on the Street, when producer Barry Levinson took this idea from David Simon, he did it. David Simon, TV producer, did The Wire. It's probably his most famous thing. It's what happened he did after Homicide: Life on the Street. But originally he wrote a book where he followed this real homicide squad in Baltimore, Maryland for a year. And he wrote a book about it, a nonfiction book. And Barry Levinson and Paul Anastasio, I think was the showrunner, they read that book and they're like, let's make this into a TV show. Let's make a TV show that's different than all the other cop shows. So they called up this guy named Tom Fontana that they wanted to be one of the writers. And the way they pitched the show to him, they said, here's the pitch. It's a cop show with no car chases, no gunfights. Thinking cops limitation. And it's just like saying, when I paint this, I'm only going to use pastels. I'm only going to use earth tones. So setting limitations is like selecting your palette. As Ruben says, the goal of art isn't to attain perfection. The goal is to share who we are and how we see the world. And of course, that goes back to the idea that our imperfections are what we contribute to the process. So when we contribute imperfections and we understand that perfection is not our goal, then what we're really looking for is the imperfections, and what the imperfections give us is who we are in that moment. That's what we are contributing to the world. And it's also about how we see the world. We're contributing our perspective, going back to perspective. Now, I seem to remember a passage in Colin Wilson's book, The Outsider. It's been a long time since I read the book. I need to reread it. And in the passage, I believe, if I remember correctly, what he is asserting is that the outsider serves a purpose in society, that the outsider isn't completely outside of society, that they still serve a purpose to society. And that purpose is, if we were to look at society as a tribe, then the outsider's job is to leave the tribe, to explore, and return. Their job is to go out, to see what cannot be seen from the inside, to see what it looks like from the outside, to look at the inside from the outside, but to also see what is outside, and to bring all of that knowledge of those things that are beyond people's perspectives back to the tribe, back to the society. And that's what I think about when I think about what we contribute as who we are and how we see the world. For example, Van Gogh, when we think of Starry Night, if we are using reality and perfection as a measure of value, then Starry Night is a terrible painting, because that's not what a starry night looks like. But that's not what Starry Night is a painting of. Starry Night is a painting of what Van Gogh saw when he looked at the night sky. It is a painting of his perspective, much like what we're doing here. I'm not summarizing Rick Rubin's book. I'm taking pieces that I thought were interesting from the book. I'm bringing them together and I am filtering them through me. I am giving you my perspective of what he is saying. And once again, when I do these books, it's not about me saying whether I believe what the person is saying in the book. All I'm saying is this stuff is interesting, and this is what sense I can make of it. What sense I can make of it. Imperfections and all. But the desire for perfection is rooted, how can I say this? The desire for perfection is rooted in the belief that the current thing that you are making, whatever you're working on, is going to define you forever. For example, this episode. If I'm caught up in the idea of perfection with this episode, then what I'm actually thinking, part of that process of what I'm thinking there, what I'm fearing is that somebody will hear this episode and then that's all they will ever think of me. And in a way, it goes back to what I was talking about, the Wheel of Fortune. People finding you when you're not ready. That is a fear. That's why it's good to be invisible and unknown while you're learning. But what we're fearing is that this one thing is going to define us forever. So because of that, we have to perfect it, right? Because if this is all anybody's ever going to hear, all anybody's ever going to see of me and think of me, then it has to be perfect, because I want them to see me as perfect. And that is similar to the scarcity mindset. Because if you believe you only have one good idea, then the execution of what you do is never going to be good enough. So perfection becomes an obstacle, because no matter what you do, it'll never be good enough if you think that's the only thing you can ever contribute. If I think I can only make one episode, I'm never going to publish it, because it's never going to be good enough. What allows me to do this episode is the fact that I know I'm going to be able to do another one, and another one, and another one. When we place too much importance on a work of art, we actually chain it. We strap it down. We confine it. We constrict it. We become too concerned with it when we think it's important. So we start to proceed with caution when we actually should be proceeding with abandon. We should be wildly creating, not tiptoeing. But we tiptoe when we think what we're doing is super important. I'm saving the world. No, you're not. You're just recording a podcast episode. Take a pill. Have fun. So the artist needs to be able to detach themselves from the outcome of that process. Because once again, it's not about the outcome, right? It's not about the artifact. So you have to detach yourself from that final outcome. You need to be able to work despite all the chatter and all the crap and thoughts in your head, all the pressures to succeed, all that. You gotta be able to push all that off. Rubin brings up the concept of papancha. It's a Buddhist word for this chatter in your head, this overload of mental chatter in your head. You have to free yourself from the papancha. I think he gives that term to someone who's having problems with it. And it helps them because now they hear that noise and they go, oh, it's just papancha. And they can push it off because now they've named it. You know, it's like Voldemort. Voldemort's only scary if you refer to him as he who cannot be named. But once you give him a name, it's just, oh, it's him. To quote Rubin, there is no right version. Every work of art is simply an iteration. I love that. Every work of art is simply an iteration. It's just a version. And the Grateful Dead were a great example of that, right? Every time they recorded a song, it was just an iteration, and they would reiterate in many different ways. There's no right version. It's just that version. This is just this version. This is the version I chose. You know, Prince gave that song to Sinead O'Connor, and it was a huge hit. Then he recorded his own version. It's just a different version. It's just an iteration. So when we are in the practice, sometimes a good way to detach ourselves is to distract ourselves. Distraction could be a really beneficial tool. Oftentimes by occupying one part of our brain, usually something like through using your motor skills or something, doing something practical, you know, folding laundry. Like yesterday, I had this great idea on how to solve a problem. I had this technical problem with the podcast feeds, and I wanted to move one to another spot, but I couldn't move it because it's a long, long, boring story. But I didn't know what I was going to do, and I was trying to get help from the Substack technical team, and I just got to a point where I was frustrated, and I had this bag of laundry that had been sitting there for a couple of days. It was clean clothes, but I just hadn't, you know, it was like socks. I just hadn't put them in the drawer. So I said, fine, I'm just going to walk away from this problem right now. I'm just going to go roll the socks up and put them in the drawer. And I go in the room and I'm rolling the socks up. I'm putting them in the drawer and I'm venting. My dog's laying there. So I'm venting to my dog, just my frustration. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just kind of talking it out. And then all of a sudden it hits me. Why are you worried about that? Why don't you just accept the fact that the main thing you do is actually the book podcast, and that the dispatches is actually an additional thing? That the main thing is actually the book podcast. So if the main thing is the book podcast, that's what the Substack should be called. So then your feed can just stay where it is already. And then all you have to do is move the dispatches to a new section, and then problem solved. Because I occupied another part of my brain. I was doing something else. And the reason that works is because when we pay attention to a different part of our brain, we're able to somehow let go of that other part that's slowly clamping down, and that opens again. And what it opens again to is the signal. That's one of the benefits of analog things sometimes, is doing things in the analog world can free us up. Rick Rubin says, distraction is not procrastination, which reminds me of another quote, one that I quote all the time. This is from Victor Hugo, from Les Miserables. And he says, a man is not idle because he is absorbed in thought. There is a visible labor and there is an invisible labor. Which means just because you're sitting there thinking about something doesn't mean you're not doing something. Distraction is not procrastination. Distraction is sometimes an official tool and a part of the creative act. And when we talked earlier about art as a practice, a way of being, but a practice we can compare to something like meditation, in that there's no wrong way to do it. There's no wrong way to meditate. Any meditation instructor or teacher out there that's worth their salt will tell you there's no wrong way to meditate, because meditation is a practice. You're either doing it or you aren't. There is no wrong. You're either meditating or you aren't. And in the same way, creating. You're either creating or you aren't. There's no wrong way to do it. You're either doing it or you aren't. So what is the creative act? What is art? It's experimentation. It's not about that final outcome. It's not about that artifact. It's not about success or failure, which is why you can't do it wrong. Art is about what we learn from the process itself. It's not about the painting that you end up with the first time you try to paint. It's what you learn about working with paints, making that first painting. And the same thing is true of your 1,000th painting. It's not about the 1,000th painting. You know, Da Vinci, Mona Lisa wasn't about the Mona Lisa and thinking one day somebody's going to put this in a museum and everybody's going to call it the most famous painting in the world. No, for him, it was about what can I learn right now about the human anatomy and the face, and how can I make those eyes sparkle in a way that makes them look human like no other painting has before. It was about what he learned in the process. It wasn't about the little small painting that is the Mona Lisa. Thomas Edison, there's a famous story about Thomas Edison, some apocryphal story about Thomas Edison, that when he was trying to perfect the light bulb, he was trying to work on the what materials to use for the filaments, and everything he tried would fail. It would break or burn out or it wouldn't light. And supposedly he went through thousands of different iterations and just kept not working. And the story goes that somebody said, how do you keep going after you've failed so many times? And supposedly, his response was, I haven't failed. I've simply just found thousands of ways not to make the light bulb. It's about what you learn in the process. It's not about the final outcome. And one of these things that we get confused in our head is we often think about the discovery phase, the phase of coming up with cool ideas. We often think that's creativity, that that is the whole of creativity, that creative people come up with cool ideas. But that discovery phase is just the first phase. An artist isn't just someone who comes up with cool ideas. An artist is someone who comes up with cool ideas and then crafts them. Remember the abstract thinker, the artist brain, and then the craftsperson brain? And that transfer process, the artist goes through that and becomes a craftsperson and brings something into tangible, well, not tangible always, because is a song tangible, but into reality. Takes it from amorphous and gives it shape. So after discovery comes crafting. That's when we build. That's when we decide. That's when we work. It's also when we experience discomfort and difficulty. But that is part of the creating. To reiterate the point again, as I say about writing all the time, writing is editing. The first draft is not writing. That's just the first draft. Everything that comes afterwards is writing. Hemingway said, quote here again, but I'm going to curse again, first draft of everything is shit. Because the first draft of everything is just the starting place. It's imperfect in a way that needs to be worked with. I also think of a book that we talked about, our first book, The Dip, that this exciting phase when we have this new idea, that's the discovery phase. The dip comes when we try to transfer that into the crafting phase. That's where the dip is. Oh, hello, imperfection. Hello, thing that doesn't look like the thing in my head. Ugh, this sucks. And what's important about the process or the practice of creating is to also cultivate consistency and discipline. Because contrary to popular opinion, consistency and discipline in a creative habit, they don't restrict your freedom to create, but paradoxically, they actually free you. They free you up. This is something David Allen talks about in Getting Things Done, this idea of productivity, capturing everything and then putting it into a system you can trust and giving everything a date and a context. And the reason he says you go through all this stuff is so that you don't have to think about these things anymore. You can let them go and you can achieve mind like water, a state where you don't have to worry, am I doing the right thing right now? Because you know you are. I don't have to think about anything right now except for recording this. if I had to think of 5 or 6 other things that I should be doing right now, I couldn't focus to do this. So by having the discipline and the consistency, I know I can do this and not think about anything else. So when we go to practice, we have to be careful not to rely solely on inspiration, to rely solely on the signal. Because when all we do wait for inspiration, what we end up spending most of our time doing is waiting. If you spend most of your time waiting, you don't create very much. Oftentimes, you don't create anything if you just sit around and wait for the next chapter. So in the time when you're waiting for the signal, waiting for that wheel to come back around, you work. You work on something else. You do boring stuff if you have to. You fold the laundry. You edit. Edit is not something that requires inspiration. You do the editing until an idea, an inspiration comes around. Then you work with that inspiration. Then you go back to the editing. You go back to the work part. You go back to the crafting. Accept inspiration when it comes and work in the meantime. Wheel of Fortune. Be in the right place when it's time. Be working. There's a famous phrase that I grew up around a lot of Christians, something that Christians like to say, Jesus is coming, look busy. You know, be doing something, be working. And when we think about choices when it comes to creating, we don't want to have to waste our energy, waste our choices on deciding when we create. We want all of the energy for choosing to be things that we choose while creating. Should this be read? Should this be louder? Do I need this paragraph? We don't need to be thinking, should I paint today? Should I paint tomorrow? Maybe I should paint next week. That's a waste of energy. Set a schedule. Make a consistency. Don't have to think about that. Free that up so that you can save all of that choice-making power for the actual craft. A lot of this is more philosophical, but it doesn't give a ton of practical tips, but there are some offered, some things you can try. Like, for example, when you're working and you reach a difficult fork, you know, like, what do I do here? Should I use a piano for this song or should I write this one with guitar? If you go back to listen to there's Exile on Main Street by the Rolling Stones, there's like a super expanded version where they have like every demo and every version that they did when they were recording the album. There's some songs in there that you could hear where they wrote one version with guitar and they did another version with piano. And that embodies exactly what Ruben says to do here. So when you reach a difficult fork, you know, should I use piano? Should I guitar? Do both. Do them both at the same time. Not literally the same time, but, you know, like do a piano version, then do a guitar version. He says that by doing both, you're actually less attached to result. So maybe the piano version is the right version in the end. But if you only craft the guitar version, you're not going to be like, nah, maybe we should go try that piano. Because all you crafted was the guitar version, you're going to keep perfecting and trying to work with that guitar version. And the piano version is just going to be, you know, slowly disappearing. You know, it's just not coming into reality. So you have to be less attached to what you do by just do both. And when you're testing ideas, you want to limit that to 2 choices because otherwise things get too complicated. So like, for example, if it's guitar or piano, okay, let's do guitar and piano. Here's the guitar version. Here's the piano version. And because there's only 2, he says from his experience in the studio, what almost always happens is automatically there's one that you're drawn to just a little bit more, even if sometimes it's a lot bit more, but sometimes it's just a little bit more. And what this made me think of is when you go to the optometrist, you know, they don't put on like 15 different glasses. Do these glasses make you see better? Or do glasses B make you see better? What about glasses J? What about glasses K? What about glasses? They don't give you all the glasses and make you figure out which ones make you see better. They put you in that thing and they go, which one's better, this or this? A or B? And there's always one that's just, you know, sometimes you can't tell, but it's just a little bit more. And you go, B. Okay. Then they go to the next one, C or D. And you go through that whole thing, and all that does is it slowly, incrementally moves you closer to the correct prescription. And that's what limiting yourself to 2 choices can do. according to Ruben. Another thing when you're working is often, like for him with music, you're working with other people. And he says that the biggest obstacle sometimes to working with other people is that when cooperation disappears and all of a sudden competition shows up. And the way it shows up generally in these situations is people start to get concerned about their ideas. That my idea is the right one. Instead of thinking, what is the best for this song? It's about, no, my idea, not his idea, my idea. But what if his idea is the better one? That goes back to the detachment. And it also reminds me of Benjamin Franklin, the book we read about Benjamin Franklin from Walter Isaacson, when he talked about being at the Constitutional Congress. And he said, I think we should have an executive panel, or whatever word he used, instead of one president. It should be multiple people. People didn't go for his idea. He let it go. It wasn't about his idea being the right one. It was about working towards what was best for the country as a whole. And when working with other people, we often fear, speaking of politics, something word that comes up a lot, polarization. We often fear polarization when working with others. I want this and he wants this and they're so far apart. And Ruben says, good. That's awesome. Because the distance between your idea and their idea creates tension. And that tension is dynamic. And it expands what's possible with what you're doing. If everybody kind of wants the same thing, then you're missing out on a lot of other stuff, a lot of other ideas. And then when working with other people, you also have to consider feedback. So when you give feedback, he says, you should be as specific as possible about what you're saying. Not like, I don't like this. You got to say, the drums here don't work. I think they might be a little too fast or too busy. Now you've given them something specific to look at, to consider. But he says, what's also important is that you say that, but then you don't say, therefore, you should do this. Don't offer them a solution. Let them think it out. And then if they can't figure it out and they ask you, do you have any ideas? Then you present an idea. And that makes for better working together. And in reverse, when you receive feedback, the first thing you should do is repeat back what you think they just said. Are you saying that you think the drums are sloppy? No, I didn't say sloppy. I said busy. Oh, okay. Now let's think about that. And the reason why you want to do this is because you want to actually hear what they're saying. Because you don't always hear what they're saying. You hear what you think they're saying. So when you hear what they're saying, then you can react. But you will be reacting to what they actually said instead of what you think they said. And this is kind of lessons for life. This is not just for creating. Because listening is communication. Listening is a form of communication. Which actually brings me around to what I think is the key personal insight in this book. And I say personal insight as in this is something that is insightful, especially to me, beyond the realm of just the creative act. And in fact, this is something that I think Rick Rubin himself personifies. That people who meet him, this is one of the things that they say about him. And the point is, listening is communication. Listening. The importance of listening. In fact, on a recent episode of Joe Rogan, one of those Protect the Park episodes where he has his friends and they just kind of get hammered, one of them tried to make fun of Rick Rubin, you know, saying that he was, I guess, trying to live off of something he did in the 90s. And Joe tried to stop him and said, no, that's actually who he is. It's not an act or anything. That is who he is. The guy generally tries to go into a room and not be the smartest person in the room. So let me pull out three parts. So there's like one big quote. I just pulled out three parts of it. So these all kind of fit together, but there's stuff that goes in between. But these three really, as far as what I'm taking from this beyond creativity from this book, these three are something that I'm really trying to think about and to focus on. So I'm just going to read all three of them together, like they're one quote. But like I said, they're broken up in reality. When the listener is totally present, the speaker often communicates differently. Most people aren't used to being fully heard, and it can be jarring for them. Formulating an opinion is not listening. Neither is preparing a response or defending our position or attacking another's. To listen impatiently is to hear nothing at all. Listening is suspending disbelief. That's powerful. When you actually listen to someone, you're fully present and listening, and you're not running that papancha, that chatter in your head while someone else is talking, or trying to interject, or thinking about how you're going to disagree with what they're saying, and you actually listen to what they're saying, the way you would a podcast, you know, like you listen to what people are saying. Maybe even greater than that, like maybe we don't even listen to that very well. But when you do that, the person who's talking will begin to communicate differently. What I think about there is I think about Robert Caro. He's one of the most famous biographers of all time. And when he went to interview people for these books that he did, he was one of the most meticulous biographers. And people would always ask him, how did you get these details? And oftentimes these details that he would get that nobody else got came from interviewing people, and he would just ask them the question. And then at another point, he would ask them the question. So he continually asked the same question over and over again. And each time something different, you know, some small little detail would be added or something, or they'd suddenly remember something this time that they didn't remember the first three or four times. Like, I think one of the stories that he was talking to one of Lyndon Johnson's limo drivers or whatever, and asking him, so what was he like when he was in the car? And he got like a nonsense answer over and over again. And then finally he remembered, oh, you know, that reminds me, one time he was doing this, and I remember him. And that's the way our memory works. You know, we don't always remember everything. Sometimes what's going on in our life provides context that sparks our memory. Another thing that it reminds me of is another interviewer, Cal Fussman. When Tim Ferriss first started out, he was one of the people that gave him advice on interviewing. And what Fussman told Tim Ferriss was, let the silence do the work. Oftentimes when interviewers ask questions, if the person doesn't answer right away, they try to add something. Well, what I'm saying is, or, you know, they try to jumpstart them. But what Fussman says is just sit. Let them think. Let the silence bring them to an answer. That's what I'm reminded of here, that people communicate differently when your intention is to actually listen to them. Which makes sense. If you're continually thinking of a way to respond to someone, to one-up them, or to argue with them, they're going to get that. So the way they communicate is going to become combative as well. So try to be fully present and to actually hear what is being said, as opposed to already formulating something in our minds. And speaking of formulating, he says, formulating an opinion, that's not listening. Communicating, responding, defending, all those things, of course they're not, because they're all some form of an exercise in the ego. It's about you and it's not about the other person. But I think one of the top four quotable lines in this book is to listen impatiently is to hear nothing at all. You know, I said earlier that this book reminds me of a book of aphorisms. That's an aphorism right there. You could tell he's read a lot of Buddhist thinking and stuff with aphorisms, because he formulates his sentences in that way as well, and ends up creating his own. To listen impatiently is to hear nothing at all. So to truly listen, you have to suspend disbelief. Crazy. Think about that. To listen, to truly listen, you have to open yourself to their signal. Taking it back to the beginning. So, life lesson there. One that I struggle with. I'm sure you do. Everybody does. I don't know anybody that's an amazing listener. Some better than others, but nobody that's amazing. So, the idea of, once again, I said there, listening is suspending disbelief. It relates to this idea that he also believes that art requires curiosity about possibilities. You have to be open to what's possible with these ideas. And so it's not just faith that the idea can come to life, but you have to be open to all the possibilities of what it could be. Remember, he said that art is iteration. There's no right version. There's just iterations. Those are the possibilities. So in order to see this, you know, the also the we talked about ending up a place where you didn't expect innovation. That's being open to that possibility, being curious about it. So we have to keep our minds open. We have to be open to those possibilities. And when we face obstacles in the creative process, often the reason for it is because we've closed our minds. We're restricting our beliefs about what's possible. So we think, oh, it has to be this guitar version. Whereas if we had kept our mind open, we could be remembering there's also the piano version. There's also a version with a flute. Crazy thought, but maybe it works. And then all of a sudden you have a band called Jethro Tull. Who would have thought you could have a quote-unquote metal band with a flute? Remaining open to the possibilities. Which for me brings us around to editing. One of the things that he suggests you do when you get near the end of a project is to do a severe edit and to reduce everything. Take it all down to the skeleton. Take it down to as much as you could possibly take it down to, and even a little bit beyond that, so that you can actually see the core of what you're doing there. Because up until this point, everything you've done is, let's think about it in the context of a song, which is what he's coming from. Maybe you started out with a guitar line. It's like, okay, what are we going to do with this guitar line? Well, let's add a little distortion. Yeah, the distortion works. Let's add a bass line. Yeah, okay, how about some drums? Everything you've done up until this point has been additive. So you don't know what's necessary. You only know what you've added to get where you are before. I've made tracks before using Logic Pro. And sometimes, you know, you end up with like 15 tracks. And you go back and you go, what's track two? And it's this bass line. It's this bass line you can barely hear. So you mute it and you realize, well, the song is no different without it. I don't need it. Then you have this other part and you think, oh, this part's so good. And then you take it out and you go, actually, it's better without that piano. So you start editing. It's like, for example, the famous story of Prince When Doves Cry. That is a funk song. When Doves Cry is a funk song. But the funny thing is, the key component of almost every funk song, maybe except for When Doves Cry, is the bass line. There's always a funk bass line. When he wrote that song, it had a funk bass line. And then during the editing process, he removed the bass line and he liked it better. So When Doves Cry is a funk song with no bass because he removed it and realized it wasn't needed and it improved the song. What I'm reminded of here is something that has been attributed to many different authors, Stephen King being one of them, Allen Ginsberg being another. Kill your darlings. This is talking about when you're writing. What kill your darlings means is sometimes when you write a scene or a sentence or a chapter that you think is super clever. It becomes your darling. You love it. People are going to think, I'm such a good writer. What you don't realize because you're so in love with that is maybe that is actually not contributing to the story. And that maybe you're keeping it just because you like it. Just because it's clever. And that the story may actually be improved by removing that. So if you kill your darlings, you pull all of the things out and you're only left with the things that are functional and not things you're in love with, then you can actually see what you need. And maybe you'll bring some of those back in because you feel like it adds something. But they won't be there just because you love them. They'll be there because you feel they belong. Also reminds me of what's been referred to as Elon Musk's algorithm. This is something I think he came up with when he was in the original plant in California for Tesla. And there's 5 steps to the algorithm. Number 1, question every requirement. Number 2, delete any part or process you can. Number 3, simplify and optimize. Number 4, accelerate cycle time. Number 5, automate. I want to pay attention specifically right now to 2. Delete any part or process you can. This is a quote from Musk, but it's from Walter Isaacson's book about him. He says, You may have to add them later, the things you delete. You may need to add them back later. In fact, if you do not end up adding back at least 10% of them, then you didn't delete enough. So this is the idea of reducing things to the skeleton and even going beyond that, reducing more than you need. You can see it with what he's done with Twitter. It's being criticized, but he's doing exactly what he did with Tesla and with SpaceX. He went in, he cut way more staff than he should have, and then he's added back what he needed. Whether you think that's right or wrong, that's not what this is about. It's just the idea, the process here of editing and understanding what's needed. Don't operate off of assumptions. Understand, which in a way relates back to the listening thing. Don't operate off of what you think they said. Know what they said. And an important distinction here when you're editing is to understand the difference between the critic and the editor, which we often confuse because maybe part of this is because of language, because an editor can be critical. The editor side of your brain is critiquing what you're doing. But there's a difference. I'll tell you how Rubin says it, and then I'll tell you how I say it. Rubin says the critic doubts the work, undermines it, zooms in and picks it apart. The editor steps back, views the work holistically, and supports its full potential. The way I say that is, the editor fortifies while the critic erodes. The editor's job is to make things better. The critic's job is to make you give up, to undermine the value of the whole thing. You have to be able to tell the difference between those two voices. Another thing that's important, probably more than anything when dealing with editing, is practice of patience. You have to be patient. It's frustrating. Everything can be frustrating in the creative act, but you have to cultivate patience. And this quote is, there's two quotes in this book. I said there's like four. These two quotes, the next two quotes I'm going to give you, are the two most quotable quotes from this book. The two that I will never forget that have been swimming in my head ever since I read them, even beyond when I forgot where I read them and where they came from, they've become part of my thinking. The first one is, impatience is an argument with reality. The desire for something to be different from what we are experiencing in the here and now. I'm going to read that again because I think it's so good. Impatience is an argument with reality. The desire for something to be different from what we are experiencing in the here and now. Patience. Saying, No. This isn't how it's supposed to be. And there's an arrogance to that. There's a sense that we deserve for things to always be the way we desire them. These people shouldn't be driving so slow. How dare they do that to me? This person is talking too much. How dare they not let me talk? We are outraged when reality does not bend to our whims. That's impatience. Impatience is an argument with reality. Almost a mic drop. The reason I say almost is because after that, I have to contribute this quote. The way we do anything is the way we do everything. That one is such a gut punch to me. The way we do anything is the way we do everything. If you're impatient when you put away your laundry, I bet you're impatient with a bunch of other stuff. If you are meticulous with details at work, then I bet you're meticulous with details at home. Aphorisms. Those are things to sit and think about. Another thing about the creative act. You need to be able to get lost in it. You need to be able to get lost in the process. This goes back to the mind like water thing again. One of the examples here is that when Rubin is in a session with an artist, either him or somebody else is always taking extensive notes of everything that's going on. Okay, we took the drums and we reduced the volume of the drums by 10%. We added in a bass line. We had an idea that maybe we should add piano. We're not going to do it now. Extensive notes on everything. Why? Because it frees them from having to remember those things. So that in 3 days, 4 days, when they hit a block and they're like, oh, why are the drums like this again? Go back to the notes. Oh, it's because we reduced them by 10%. Can we bring them back up 10%? You bring them back up to, there's, okay, there's, yeah, okay, that's, Something else is not working here. Well, we considered doing the piano. Yeah, let's do the piano thing. The notes free them from the burden of having to keep those in the memory so that they can be lost in the process. And if you've ever done editing, editing's frustrating, but you get lost in editing too. You get lost in the sounds. That's why you end up having to do the kill your darling things, because you got lost. And you have to step back and go, okay, put a different hat on. But with all that said, while we should be patient during crafting, during editing, and all of those things, it also has to be said that there is a value, an importance, maybe an essential importance, to having an expiration date, having a deadline. In other words, I could spend all this time working on the song. You can have as much time as you want. But as you start to get to a certain point, you go, okay, but we do need to finish this in the next week. And the reason for that is every work of art, as I said, is a snapshot of who we are in the moment. And if you stay with a work of art for too long, you change. And now all of a sudden a different person is creating this. And they're working with the work of a different person. So now you have two people that you're trying, and one you can't even talk to anymore because that person doesn't exist anymore. So you have to be able to finish a work of art in the time frame where you are still the person who started it to some degree, or as much or as quickly as possible as you can. Which reminds me of a quote from The Writing Life by Annie Dillard. Another longer quote, but this is about the idea of getting something done or trying to get done in a specific time. This is about writing, as you can tell from a book called The Writing Life. I do not so much write a book as sit up with it, as with a dying friend. During visiting hours, I enter its room with dread and sympathy for its many disorders. I hold its hand and hope it'll get better. This tender relationship can change in a twinkling. If you skip a visit or two, a work of art will turn on you. A work in progress quickly becomes feral. It reverts to a wild state overnight. It is barely domesticated, a Mustang on which you one day fasten the halter, by which now you cannot catch. It is a lion you cage in your study. As the work grows, it gets harder to control. It is a lion growing in strength. You must visit it every day and reassert your mastery over it. If you skip a day, you are quite rightly afraid to open the door to its room. You enter its room with bravura, holding a chair at the thing and shouting, "Simba!" Simba, I guess, is like the name of a famous lion. Crack that whip. But that's the thing. The book, having worked on a novel that I thought was going to be a novel, which is now a different Substack from this one, for like 15 years, I can tell you that both of these things are true. That it becomes hard when you change. The person telling the story is a different person. And that if you walk away from something and you come back, you're like, whoa! And that's because not only about the change in who you are, but also because a work, when we work on something creative, as much as we can take extensive notes, there's a ton of stuff that we have in working memory. You know, when you're writing a novel, you can't take notes of everything. You know, you may have specific details down, you know, like this character has brown hair and he's about 5'6". There's a whole bunch of things about that character that you have in your mind, in your working memory. And when you go to do something, you're just accessing it. You're not even thinking about it. You're accessing it like it's a real person. If you walk away for like 6 months and you come back and you forget some of those things, how can you write the next scene when you no longer know those things? So it becomes almost untamable. So sooner or later, you have to set a deadline, a point at which you're going to declare, this is done. I'm finished. Otherwise, you're always going to find an excuse to put it off, to delay it a little bit longer. It kind of goes back to the idea of if you think this is important and this is the one thing everybody's going to define you by, you're always going to find a reason to improve it. This is supposed to be a snapshot, not a piece of perfection. In a snapshot, there's a moment that the picture is taken. There has to be a moment. And that ability to let go and to move on, that's what allows creativity to flow through us. That is creativity flowing. Us creating and moving on, that is flow. So when we stay on something, some piece or some project or some idea for too long, or we have an idea and we hold it in and we never do anything with it and we don't give it to anybody else and we just hold on to it, everything stops. Because we've blocked the flow. We've literally blocked the flow. That's not a way of saying, ooh, the flow has stopped in some metaphorical sense. That's a literal stop of the creative flow, because that is literally the thing that we have stopped. The moving on. I think about something I've written about previously, the idea of what I call executive disruption. Now, I'm on the autism spectrum, so I experience something that I've heard is common to other people on the spectrum, this idea of not being able to use our executive functions as well at certain points, that certain things are just, all of a sudden I realize, I can't handle doing this thing that I normally would do. I just can't put the pieces together. And often what I find is what kicks this in is something to do with the way I'm organized. I'll use an example of note-taking apps or note-taking in general. I could be going for 3-4 months taking all my notes in a Leuchtturm journal, which I say that because there's one in front of me right now. And suddenly I decide, you know, I think I want to take notes on the computer and I want to do them in Obsidian. Let's try the Obsidian app. So I start moving some stuff in the Obsidian app and I realize, okay, oh, you know, this would be better if I had the stuff from the paper journal in here so that when I'm writing the new notes, I can reference those things. I go to write a note, a new note in the app. And suddenly I'm wondering, well, where do I put it? Because, you know, I'm busy moving this stuff over. I haven't really organized where all this stuff is going to go. And I don't want to create a bigger mess. And so I start worrying about that. And then what happens is I just hold everything in my head, which, as I said, you can't really do. So I literally block myself. And I end up getting to a place where I'm no longer taking notes because I don't know what to do. There's no automatic process for me here. So I just stop. I break the flow. So you have to be able to move on. You have to be able to keep the flow going. And that means having a deadline, going, it's done. And it is what it is. Now, the abundance mindset, as opposed to the scarcity mindset that we talked about earlier, the abundance mindset says, it's okay because the flow is always flowing. There's always more. It's not just this one thing you're doing. You don't need to hold on to it. There's more. There's always going to be another idea. Two things I think of. First of all, I think of this quote or this interview piece that I heard from Dolly Parton a long time ago. And somebody was talking about theft or something like that. And she was talking about how she kept her money in like the top drawer of her dresser and she didn't lock it up or something like that. And people would ask her, well, what if somebody breaks in your house and takes the money? And she always said, well, I guess they needed it more than I did. Abundance mindset. The other thing I think of is there's a documentary called Stripped. There's actually multiple documentaries called Stripped. One about strippers. This one is not about strippers. This one is about comic strips. In particular, it's about comic strip writers. Now, there was a famous comic strip in the 80s and I think even going back to the 60s called Beetle Bailey. And the creator's name was Mort Walker, I believe. And he was in this documentary. And one of the things that he said is actually pretty much the main thing I remember from this documentary. Is he's talking about the process of writing a daily comic. You know, these guys are writing a comic strip every day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, I think. So close enough, right? Consistently writing ideas. And people are always asking him, how are you consistently funny every day? And he said, we're not. He said, what you discover as a comic strip writer, a daily comic strip writer, is you got to put something out every day, but you only have to be funny once a week. You only have to nail it once a week. Because if you're, I think I've mentioned this in an episode before, if you're funny once a week, if you're funny once in that week, that is, all they're going to remember is that strip. And they'll completely forget the other six even existed. Abundance, moving forward, get it out. You know, think about that with authors. There are very few authors you could say everything they wrote is their best book. You know, it's a classic. Even people like Haruki Murakami, who I believe is very consistent throughout his career, there are books that are better than others. That's just the way it works. And you have to accept that because it's a snapshot of who you are. It's not a judgment of who you are. Now, ironically, if I had been caught up in being clever, I might have moved that section to like the end of this so that I was the last section when we were finishing is about finishing. But there's actually something that comes after finishing, and that's evaluating. That's looking back at what you've done. It's looking at the process, letting other people look at what you've done, what you've made. When you think that you don't like something that you've made, but you're thought is it's okay because these kind of people will like it. I don't like it, but there's a market for it here. You're not necessarily making art. Sometimes it could still be art, but what you're definitely doing is commerce. And I guess what he's really hinting at here with this idea is that everything you create, you should like it, that you should be creating it for you. And it's also important to note that the more what you do, more what you create is mimicking what's popular out there, what's trendy out there, or the more it follows a formula, the more likely it is to be commerce and the less likely it is to be art. Because going back to what we've been saying over and over and over again, art is an expression of the individual. It's an expression of who you are in the moment. It is not an assimilation of consensus. It's not doing what you think everybody's going to like. It's expressing who you are. Remember when we started from the beginning, we haven't brought this up in a while. It's seeking something beyond you. And copying something is not, or trying to fit into a pocket is not, it's not seeking. It's mimicry. That's commerce. And I think that's why religious movies or woke movies or nationalistic movies are so freaking boring. Unless you're like the person who's on the tip of that exact belief, everybody else yawns through those movies. They yawn through them because they're not expressing an individual experience. It's not something that's coming from within. They're projecting an ideology outward. They're affirming an identity. They're not seeking. And that's boring. So boring. And at times, condescending. Let me give you two descriptions of a book about fishing. You tell me which one you're most likely to read. Assuming even that you're not a person interested in fishing, which is even more important here. First book, the most succinct way I can describe the first book is fishing is awesome. Second book, fishing is an essential skill for survival in an emergency situation. Here are the lessons I learned in my years of fishing. Which one's more interesting? The first one says fishing is awesome. You know who's going to be interested in that book? People who already think fishing is awesome. And even they might be bored with the book because they already know fishing is awesome. The second one says, this book is about a journey. It's about an individual. It is about what I have learned and how to apply to a situation. You might still not want to read that second book, but you're more likely to read that book than the first one. Which is why Rubin says art needs a point of view. In other words, a perspective from which the art is coming. But it doesn't need a point. It doesn't need a message. And often he finds that when people finish something, that's when they realize what they've created is actually about. But if you start from the beginning to make something to fit a message, it's usually super lame. Because there's no exploration. There's no experimentation. There's no journey. You're just filling out a form. The artist's freedom, their freedom comes from when they are creating. That's where they are free. The artist is free when they are creating. But the audience, their freedom comes from when they interpret it. That's when their freedom comes. In other words, what they think it means, that's their right to decide. I couldn't find this interview because I haven't seen it in decades. But there's an interview a long time ago where Eddie Vedder, I think it was after 10, their first album came out. I think the interviewer was asking him to explain his lyrics, and he said that he wouldn't discuss his lyrics because he believes that the songs, they're what they meant to him when he was writing them. That's him when he's creating it. But once they go out in the world, they no longer belong to him. They belong to the audience. And when they belong to the audience, then the lyrics mean whatever they mean to them. And if he were to tell them what he thought the lyrics meant, then he'd be telling them, no, what you interpret from that is wrong. And so he didn't want to take that away from them. The artist's freedom is in creating. The audience's freedom is in the right to interpret that. So with that said, the final point I will take from this book is something we all also have to keep in mind when we create things, including podcasts about books. This is actually a quote from Rubin. The best art divides the audience. If everyone likes it, you probably haven't gone far enough. If everyone likes it, you haven't gone far enough. The worst, I always say this, the worst thing that somebody can say when you've spent a lot of time creating something and go, it's good. Just this kind of wishy-washy answer. It's so much better if somebody hates it because at least they felt something. But if they just give you a wishy-washy answer, it means they didn't feel anything, which means you didn't do enough. Love it or hate it, but that's a reaction. You know, love and hate are like flip sides of a coin. The opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. So we can go back again to Musk's algorithm, you know. If you don't put 10% back, then you didn't go far enough. If you're not dividing people on their opinions of something, then you didn't put enough of yourself into the process. And actually, I mentioned earlier that I grew up around Christians. There's a part in the Bible that talks about this. It's in Luke 12:51. I wrote it down so that I would remember. Jesus says to people, he says, "Do you think I've come to establish peace on earth? I assure you, the contrary is true. I have come for division." Whoa, wait a minute. What? Jesus? Jesus didn't come for peace? Don't people call him the King of Peace? He didn't come for peace. He came to divide people. Because Jesus, Elon Musk, and Rick Rubin, they understand something. Truth, expression, opinion divides people. It divides people because people either agree with it or they don't agree with it, but it exerts something strong and true. It divides people. And everything we create in some way, if we have gone far enough, will divide people. Think of every person successful. Think of all of the most successful people. People love them, hate them. Oprah, people love her, people hate her. Bill Gates, people love him, people think that he's the devil. Joe Rogan, people love him. He has tens of millions of listeners. Other people think that he is a right-wing stooge and a Nazi. If you come from a true place and you go far enough with your expression, Rick Rubin, I told you earlier, somebody had an opinion about him. You will divide people. The artist's job, as I said, is outsiders to go outside, see what is outside, and bring it back. Well, if everybody that you're bringing it back to is inside and the only thing they know, the only perception they have is this limited perspective of what they live in, and you bring something from outside, like Kerouac, people are going to respond. They're going to accept it or they're going to deny it. It's going to divide them. This is also the job of the artist, to create purely and to some degree, to divide. Not to divide to destroy, but to divide on belief, because the audience's freedom is in the interpretation. If they interpret it good, that's their right. If they interpret it bad, that's their right. But they are divided on their opinion. So I don't know how long we've been going, but that's the end of my notes. Believe it or not, we've reached the end of the note part of it. This is what excavating is going to be like. And I went about as long as I thought I was going to go. But I have to tell you, I was a little bit nervous that I wasn't going to have the staying power, that I wasn't going to be able to get myself lost in the process, that I was going to be bored. You know, there's a lot of things going this long. I've never gone this long. But I loved it. And I hope you loved it. I really do. I put a lot of work into this. There's a time that I read the book, which means reading the book slowly, taking notes. Then there's a time I took those notes and I put them on index cards and tried to understand them, put them into an outline, tried to understand them. And then there's all the stuff that I added in there, all the things that things reminded me of, so I can give you context. Because once again, my point here is not to reiterate Rick Rubin, but to take things from Rick Rubin and add them to my knowledge and then filter them out and to create something new, to create something in my voice. And like the notes, to type in the notes and getting all of that arranged, that was like, I don't know, probably about 5 hours yesterday. Yeah, I did it all the day before. But it was a really fun process. I don't know if I'll be able to do this once a month, just because it took me about a week to prepare the episode. By the time I'm done, you know, because I'll have to edit this, which will be another day, and then there'll be the posting. So it'll be about a week for that, and then I don't know that I can read a book the way that I read this one in 3 weeks and have the notes organized like that. But we'll see. Ideally, I would love to do this once a month, but either way, it'll be consistent. I've already selected what the next book is going to be. So I, you know what? Since you've made it to the end of the episode and you're a paying subscriber, which, by the way, thank you for that. I love reading. Reading is an essential part of my identity. And I love talking about the ideas in these things. And for most of my life, I thought that there was something that I had been cursed with my interest and my skill set, that I had been given something that I could never do anything with other than learn for myself. So by doing this and you becoming a paying supporter, you move me closer to the idea that what I'm doing is actually something I can continue to do. When people ask me, hey, what do you do? This can be something I can answer. Hey, what do you do? I'm a podcaster. That's like my job. So every person that contribute gets me closer to that goal. And maybe you're listening to this sometime in the future, and maybe I've already achieved that goal. Thank you still. Thank you too. Because you allow me to do it tomorrow and the day after and the day after that. And it's really damn exciting. But since you're here, and as I said, you are a paying supporter and you've actually made it to the end, the next book that I want to excavate is a book that I mentioned in this. I want to go back and reread Colin Wilson's The Outsider, which is a big project. It's not a thick, huge book, but it is. I was flipping through it the other day to try to find the passage that I was referencing there, see if I could quickly find it. It is dense with ideas that I'm fascinated with, so I'm not sure how I'm even going to go about every. It's kind of like what I said earlier about just because you wrote one book doesn't mean you know how to write the next one. Just because you did an excavation episode on one book doesn't mean you have any idea how you're going to accomplish the next one. And I know you're a pain supporter, and I know you made it all the way to this end of this episode, and you've contributed so much to me already. But I'm going to ask you for one more thing before we get out of here. There are a lot of people that are listening to the free episodes that maybe don't want to dive in and become a paying supporter because they don't know the value and the work that I've put in to these excavation episodes. And the only way they're going to know that is if you do me the huge honor if this episode was valuable and you got something out of this and you dug it and you're into this and you can't wait for another one, tell people. Don't just, I mean, sure, I want you to tell everybody, but really, honestly, what I really want you to do is tell people who would be into this. If you have a friend that would dig this, a family member that would dig this, tell them. Tell other people, the other free subscribers, hey, you're already listening to the free episodes and you like it. You got to get the paid subscription because the excavation episodes are worth the price of admission. That's a big favor that I'm asking, but I need your help. I really need your help. So once again, don't want to keep you any longer. This has been long enough. Thank you. Thank you for coming for the first episode because this is, we know we talked earlier about getting better through the process and moving on. This is the first one. So theoretically, by that, this is the most unskilled one by that measure. They only get more skilled after this. So thank you for coming to the first one. And if you dug that, you should go buy the Creative Act, buy the physical copy of it, have it in your hand like I do right now of mine, because I've only scratched the surface of what's in this book, as I would with any other book. I could not do a worse disservice to a writer to think that you can listen to what I said about a book and not need to read their book. This should only be an appetizer as to whether you should read this book. So normally I say go read a book, but I'm going to say this. Go read this book. Go read The Creative Act.